Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for joining us on the program. We come your way Sundays at 7 a.m. and p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We stream live at richarddugan.com, newspress.com, and we archive the programs at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. I fly through the information, encouraging you to go to our website and click on the link to our guest, because our guest today is very, very interesting. I'm very excited about the discussion we're going to have today. The title of his work at this time has to do with flourishing, why we need religion in a globalized world. And Miroslav Volf, I want to thank you. Professor, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Oh, I'm delighted to be on your program. And Miroslav is good. No need for professor.
Okay. All right, Miroslav, it's fascinating to me, as I shared with you at the front end before we started, that there's sort of a, has been, at least in the latter part of the 20th century, this dichotomy of the fact of the matter is that we are flying headlong into the future, so to speak. Here we are in the 21st century. It doesn't contain anything like what I expected when I was a kid growing up watching cartoons, i.e. flying cars, among other things. But you're talking about something, the dichotomy of what I kept hearing about during what I like to refer to as my religious studies in the 80s, early 90s. The last thing that Christians especially at that time wanted, and I know we're not just focusing on them, but was the last thing they wanted was to enter into the New World Order, globalization, and all of these kinds of things. And yet, you know, here we are, 21st century, we are a global society. We are linked irreparably in one sense, irrevocably maybe isn't a better word. And you're talking about incorporating what some would say is the cause of the problems that we have in this new dynamic we call globalism, this one world, this one world community or global community of 7.5, almost 8 billion people of such divergent beliefs and philosophies. Can we start there and define for me what you mean by religion?
Well, in the book, I deal with what I describe. I use the word world religions. Religion, as such, is a very broad, of course, concept. And if you ask sociologists, they'll tell you one thing. If you ask religious studies folks, they'll tell you the other thing. If you ask legal scholars, they'll tell you even third thing. But what I mean by religion here is a kind of the great world religions like Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, Confucianism. They are embraced today by a great majority of people. And in fact, curiously enough, world is becoming more of a religious place than it used to be. And that both in absolute terms, there are more religious people, and in relative terms, that is, the greater percentage of people belong to these religious traditions. And that's why I think they're very important, especially important in what you said earlier, in a world that's becoming, smaller and smaller, interdependent, intertwined, and slowly turning into becoming a single, one world.
It's one of those things that I look at, and I'm a great observer, and of course I comment on some of the things that I observe from time to time, and I know that we all, as individuals, I mean, here's where I think a big part of the problem is that the United States in particular, over the last 200 plus years, has been really foaming at the mouth to really get across to the rest of the world this importance of individualism. Individual rights and privacy and so forth. But even you as a professor of theology and in your studies, I'm sure you have to understand that from the perspective of our spiritual lives, there is no privacy. I put it this way, that if God already knows all of my foibles, and if 7.5 billion other people want to know, that's great, but most of them just, they don't have the time. They don't care. You know, there's the NSA in the United States, and there are some others that, for whatever reason, I'm rather flattered that they would be interested in me and my life and the things that I'm doing. But the reality is that we're connected and that we interact even if we're not conscious of it, right?
Yeah, exactly. We are interconnected and we are interdependent, and you rock the boat on one side of the globe and it's going to start shaking in the other side of the globe. And I think that's the reality of interconnection. You know, I know that in the Christian tradition and in other religious traditions as well, God is the one who sees the depths of one's heart, and one cannot hide anything, so there's no privacy before God. But there is something like, I think, privacy that to me is very important. You can see that also, that something tender in us needs to grow, and for it to grow, it needs privacy. I think, say, for instance, of writers. I don't want people to see every draft that I have written. This is not quite me. I want to be able to kind of come out in public when I think I'm ready for this. And I think that's a certain forms of privacy are important for our spiritual, for our intellectual, and for our personal growth. And I think they ought to be protected.
Well, I know that I had the distinct pleasure of interviewing my parents last year, not for a broadcasted program, but one that was shared with just family. This was at their request, and I respected that. And one of the things, though, that my father shared with me is sort of along those lines, that, you know, his spirituality, his beliefs and whatever philosophy he believed in, even though he did share with us in the interview, They were private and personal, and in many instances sort of nobody else's business but his. And at the same time, of course, one of the reasons I was intrigued by doing the interview was because I wanted to learn a little bit more, in spite of the fact that I've had the opportunity over the last 56 years, you know, to talk with them and so forth. This was sort of a more of an official, if you will, inquiry on my part. But, and I tend to agree with you in that regard. And yet at the same time, we have people who are of varying belief systems, Christian and Jew and Muslim, and the list goes on. Different, not all of them, but many of them feel that it is their job, their calling, if you will, to try to get other people to go along with what they believe, and that it's their job to pass judgment on those who don't happen to follow that their particular path. And what I've experienced, and I have to say it's been a great one, is the interviews that I've done with many professing Christians of differing vocations, if you will, is the diversity of philosophy, and I'm going to use that in a broad sense instead of saying belief, that isn't necessarily in line with the teachings, the doctrine, the dogma, more so, of the faith that they espouse, that they promote. So I'm wondering about that aspect and how that plays into this whole aspect of globalism in terms of how we're going to be able to connect in such a way that we can do away with these conflicts. We will never do away with conflict in general, but I'm talking about saying, you know what? You have a right to your philosophy, to your beliefs. I have no right to tell you that you're wrong, that you're going to hell, et cetera, and that you and I, we can coexist and still have these divergent perspectives.
Yeah, I think it's essential especially in a globalized world. But that's also each of the respective nations is slowly becoming microcosm of the whole world, especially large nations like United States and immigrant nations. And I think it's essential for us to find ways in which we can, diverse as we are, live peacefully with one another. You know, I teach at Yale a course, and the course is entitled Life Worth Living. And we examine variety of philosophies and religions, like Nietzscheanism, utilitarianism, Marxism, Buddhism, Hinduism, Krishna, and so forth, right? And we examine them from the perspective of what do they say about what kind of human life is worth living. And what's interesting about all of these philosophies, actually all make claim to be true. If you talk to Nietzsche, he will say the same. That if you talk to Marx, that would have been the same. It was his point. Utilitarianism, other religions as well. So my sense is, so we need to have a sense of respect for what people believe, but at the same time, we need to be able to engage the truth questions of that are most basic for our lives. I think our lives are too important for this to be simply a matter of little preferences we have, just like I like one topping on pizza and you have another. After all, the entirety of our existence is at stake in the course throughout the life. And I think the questions of truth, especially when it comes to living together, they will matter. So what we need to do is find ways in which we can be truthful to who we are, be truthful to the vision of life that we have, but at the same time be able to converse in productive ways with others about these truth matters. So it's neither indifference to what other thinks, and I just do my own thing, nor is it an imposition. And something between indifference and imposition is what we need.
And, you know, as you share this, I think about these different concepts. And one of the things that came to my mind shortly after the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Centers back in 2001 was, has anybody sat down with any of these people who have a dislike or a hatred, if you will, for the Western way of life? Because that's my understanding of what the problem seems to be. Has anybody sat down and discussed with them what their issues are? I mean, point by point, not over screaming over a battlefield or something like this, but over a table in a conference room, if you will, and saying, hey, I really need to understand, you know, where your difficulties are with the way that we are living. And then maybe I can share with you why we live this way and so forth. And you can share with me more of, in other words, trying to get to that place of mutual respect and understanding, even though we may not necessarily fall lockstep into that way of life that they think we should live, or vice versa. You know, that's one of the struggles that I know a lot of us in the West have over this whole concept, for example, of exporting democracy. It's like, just because you say this is the greatest country in the world and the greatest system doesn't mean other people have to live by it. And we, the founding fathers and their ancestors, they had to come to a final, a breaking point. We're saying, hey, we've had enough. We're out of here. And they went across the Atlantic.
Right. Especially if you export it with a kind of backed by economic and military prowess. I'm not quite in favor of that. You know, I have been in New York. Actually, I was speaking at United Nations when the first plane hit into one of the towers. Mm-hmm. So I was speaking about reconciliation. During that time, reconciliation and how religious faiths, how my own Christian faith, I'm a Christian, how it has resources in order to foster reconciliation. And obviously, right as I was speaking that to some 300 or so, I believe, diplomats who were there, kind of proof that religion can also be violent was delivered in unmistakable form. And since that time, I was involved on a yearly basis, heavily involved in Muslim-Christian dialogue. So I do have some understanding what kinds of things motivate people who think very differently than we do. Not so much, I don't have understanding what motivates them to be destructive like this, but what alternatives they imagined providing to kind of the Western way of life. What's their gripe about Western way of life? I think there are important issues to be discussed there.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I think that it would be not only an enlightening conversation, but it would be a fascinating conversation. I hope that it would be productive as well. We cannot, quite honestly, there are people, myself included, who basically we believe that we can't go on like this. This is not, this just isn't working for all of us. And I think maybe that's where part of the problem is that there are those who don't want it to work for all. There's a select few that they want it to work for, which is one of the reasons why some of these groups, become extremely destructive. And again, it's not just these extremes of the Islamic faith, but we have it in the Christianity as well. Here in the United States, we have people who are so strongly committed to their beliefs that they will go out and, for example, the issue of abortion is so abhorrent to them that, yeah, they think that it's justifiable to kill another human being in exchange to stop them from killing other unborn human beings. And it just seems like it raises that question that I've put forth, Miroslav. Does the human race really have the right to continue with the fact that it really hasn't seemed to learn anything in the last 2,000, 4,000, 6,000 years? It's like all we do is fight.
Oh, I think we've become a little bit better. I tend to have a view of the history of humanity that the violence has proportionately decreased. That is to say, maybe not violence of every sort, but certainly the killing of human beings. I think a person about 2,000, 3,000 years ago had a greater chance of being killed than the person, the average person living in today's world. I think we are learning in some ways and we are unlearning in other ways. I think, for instance, that what we are doing to environment is rather troubling. I think we're doing a little bit better when it comes to violence and kind of political arrangements. I'd still rather live, I grew up in former Yugoslavia. I'd still rather live in a Western type democracy than I would in a former Yugoslavia, which had a basically dictatorship of the Communist Party there. So I think there are learnings and there are unlearnings. And I have this, what you may describe, kaleidoscopic view of history. We make some steps forward in some ways, some steps backward. And on the whole, it's not worse today than it was even 50 years ago.
I'm glad that you see it that way. I'm happy that there are those who do have that vision, as you have just described it, and that's important. We are looking here on this program. We're looking for those new ways of living, if you will, and talking about the new paradigms for a new world. Not the New World Order, mind you, but for a new world. And as I have, of course, it also depends upon your definition of the New World Order as well. But I know that there are different belief systems that are concerned about, especially when it comes to terminology, when talking about coexisting. I know that people were really upset when John Lennon, for example, came out with that song about, Imagine there are no religions and no borders and so on and so on and so forth. And I guess that's kind of where a lot of folks would come from as far as your book in particular, the subtitle From Flourishing, Why We Need Religion in a Globalized World. But that, I think that's a good thing because it begins the dialogue. It begins the conversation. You know, define what you mean. And I think of the biblical definition of religion having to do with taking care of the orphans and the widows and the children, you know. That's...
And then there's God there as well.
Yeah. Right?
I think one of the signature features of all great world religions is that they give, that's why I think they're very interesting and very important, is because they give primacy to what we tend not to give primacy. And that is to say, they give, all of them give primacy to transcendence. And so that the transcendent realm, be it personal God or some other form of understanding of transcendent, like Confucianism, heaven, it has primacy over ordinary life. And just by attachment to the transcendent, that attachment comes to good of ordinary life. You know, the church father Augustine has said that our hearts are restless until they find rest in God. And in many ways, I think that the consumerism in which we all engage, and especially rampant forms of it, are almost like a substitute religion. We are in search for transcendence and keep running faster and faster while staying in the same place and unable to find a deeper meaning of our lives, because I think we were created for something larger, fundamentally larger than ourselves. And so that's why I think that religions are important. That's why I think that Christian faith is important for a globalized world. We do not live by bread alone. And when we try to live by bread alone, which is what globalization basically is about, when we try to live by bread alone, there's never enough bread. We always fight around bread. Bread doesn't taste very good to us, and we need more and more of it and better, and we're never satisfied, right? Mm. And so I think this sense of this, I can get no satisfaction, to quote a rival group.
Mick Jagger.
That's endemic to the nature of life in which we live, and that's why we need reference to the divine, to God.
So let's talk a little bit about this religion you refer to, and then we'll also maybe even discuss the concept of globalism as well. I mean, and you just brought up God, and of course, God appears in many different names, both in the Bible as well as referred to by other faiths, other philosophies. And you also mentioned that you were involved with Christian-Muslim studies, if you will. Is that correct?
Or dialogue.
Dialogue.
You know, we were meeting the key leaders of the Muslim world with some of the key religious leaders, and I participated in a number of those dialogues.
I had the privilege back in the late 80s, early 90s, of interviewing the founder of an organization that at that time was out of Las Vegas, I believe, and it was called CAMP, C-A-M-P, Christians and Muslims for Peace. And what I thought, and of course, back then, I didn't think anything of what was about to come in the 90s and the 21st century. And one of the things that he shared with me, not in the interview, but afterwards, that he usually doesn't share with his groups that shares his talks with, he said that Christians and Muslims have more in common than do Christians and Jews. And I thought, wow, that's a rather extraordinary statement. And his point was that Muslims believe not that Jesus is the Messiah necessarily, but certainly more so than Jews do, that he is a prophet of God, a messenger of God, and so on and so forth. In other words, they've raised him up higher than the Jews do, but not quite as high as Christians do.
Yeah, that's right. I think that Muslims, when it comes to Christ, Muslims have, on the whole, a very positive relationship to Christ as one of the major prophets, and in that regard, they're closer to Christians. In other regards, for instance, Christians take strictly the same sacred text as Jews have. Mm-hmm. They affirm them, whereas Muslims have a kind of versions, alternatives to them, partly shaped by the Hebrew Bible. And that way, then they're again more distant from the Christian tradition. It's in some ways both end.
Yeah, I do have a little bit of a problem with this whole concept of what is referred to as jihad, because I know that in the Quran, Muhammad makes reference to, and you can correct me if I'm wrong about this, protecting the people of the book, and that was defined as it was shared with me to mean protect the Christians, because they were the ones who were called the people of the book. Am I wrong in that?
Well, Jews as well are the people of the book. So the three Abrahamic faiths are sometimes in Quran described as that they're people of the book, and mm-hmm. there's a special relation that Muslims have to the people of the book. But at the same time, there have been clearly wars, and wars understood as jihad, both against the Jews and against the Christian on the part of mm-hmm. On the part of Muslims. I think the most significant, and there's also debate about whether one sees jihad as simply moral terms, as a moral struggle, or whether it entails military struggle, greater and smaller jihad, as sometimes they're called. But I think the central element and central question that we need to ask and face is: under what conditions, with what purposes, does a particular religion legitimize the use of violence? You know, one of the things that I argue for in my book, Flourishing, is that, you know, I ask the question, well, when is it that religion are most likely to become violent? And the response to that question is when religions align themselves very closely with the political powers that be. Alliance between religion and politics is yeah. what most fundamentally, and in most cases, implicates religion in violence. Because, you know, we know that what the causes of violence generally are. Thomas Hobbes, the great philosopher, has expressed it really well. The major causes of violence are people fight for gain, for safety, and for honor or reputation. Religion doesn't play such a significant role. It starts to play a role as a legitimizing force for ideology for violence, and it does so when somehow people feel that religion is tied with their survival as a people group and as a political entity. So my sense is the more we separate religion from politics, the better we will be. The more religions become simply politically engaged, but not really politically tied, political religions, the better the situation is going to be.
Yeah, when I heard Christianity referenced for the first time in specifically the Republican campaigns back in December and January of 2015-16, I'm going, oh boy, we're going down a road that is not going to be pretty. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of the way our politics seems to be developing over the years. We're talking about Flourishing, Why We Need Religion in a Globalized World. Miroslav Volf is my guest. We're going to continue talking here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We ask you to stay tuned.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. Miroslav Volf is my guest. He's the author of Flourishing. He's written a lot of other books as well. He's a Yale professor of theology and Flourishing, Why We Need Religion in a Globalized World. Flourishing, that's something that right up there with the word thriving. I know that you probably have experienced people in your lives, if not yourself, and especially from your country of origin, we're just surviving. And then the United States, the phrase is, you know, we're surviving from paycheck to paycheck. And there are a lot of us, myself included, who are saying enough is enough. We don't want to survive anymore. We want to thrive. We want to enjoy our lives. We want to flourish and experience the abundance that, again, whatever name you choose to use, God has given us this life to enjoy, to experience, and to flourish in. And yet we find it very difficult because we're bombarded daily, if not by the hour, by so many distractions to that opportunity to flourish and thrive in this God-given life, if you will. Can we talk a little bit about that in the context of this whole globalism where we're all interconnected? By the way, I tried to come up with a phrase because that would better describe the new ism that we need to live under. Not so much religion-ism, But we've gone through the concepts of communism and socialism and capitalism and democratization. And so I came up with a phrase that's, it's a little difficult to say, but interdependentism. I don't know, maybe there's a better word you would have for that. But can we talk a little bit about that and this whole aspect of surviving versus thriving and flourishing?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to ask the question, what do we need actually to flourish? And what are the conditions under which we human beings flourish? We know the answer to that question when it comes to plants, when it comes to animals. But we are kind of a strange creature, human beings. We don't flourish that easily. And in some ways, circumstances are our enemies. And generally today, we tend to look at the circumstances and we say, you know, if I had more of this, more of that, more money, more time, whatever more of, I would be able to flourish. And, you know, it strikes me that no matter where we are and what we have, we kind of find ways not to flourish. We kind of find ways to lead a kind of a difficult lives. And I think that there's something, obviously some basic necessities need to be satisfied, but there is something profoundly in us and the way in which we perceive the world, way we relate to the world, that is essential for flourishing. For instance, I think it's important for us to see the world as a gift so that we can rejoice. We're talking these days about enjoying, you mentioned enjoyment, and that's really wonderful. Who would be against it? But often we think of enjoyment as having fun, simply. And again, who's going to be against fun? At the same time, fun is, it's kind of very flat. Joy is much deeper. I think our experience of enjoyment is deeper if we rejoice over something that we perceive as truly good. And if we rejoice over something that is good in company of others as well. And so I think what we need to nurture is kind of sense of joy and ask ourselves, what are the joy inhibitors? And what are those things that make joy possible for us? And discovering of joy, I think, is fundamental because it's related to the notion of really truly flourishing the good life.
That's an interesting word or term to use, joy. I've asked the question sort of in that same light. Why are we here? What is, you know, what is our purpose in life? That's one of those ultimate questions that we ask, you know. Yeah. Why am I here? Where did I come from? And where am I going? Kind of thing. And I started getting that response. We're here to experience joy. But what does that mean? What does it mean to experience joy? And a lot of people are now sharing that one of the aspects is to experience joy. They're using the paradigm, if you will, of connecting with or reconnecting with nature, with the natural world, that the mechanized, technological, industrial aspect of our lives, we need to disconnect from that. In spite of the fact that, what was it, Teresa of Avila said that God is amongst the pots and the pans. So there's a little dichotomy, but nonetheless, that's what I'm hearing from many of my guests is that in order to experience that joy, we need to reconnect with the natural world in whatever way we, I mean, if you're living in a big city, if you're in New York, you go to Central Park.
I'm sure that's right. Artificial environments, as much as they're part and parcel of human life, and they have been part and parcel of human life from the very beginning, but they're not the primary, and they're not all of the kind of environment that we need. We need connection with nature. But I sometimes feel that the singing praises to nature is a different way of avoiding actually dealing with concrete people. And it's actually we're social beings, fundamentally social beings. Mm-hmm. And unless we find ways to enjoy, to rejoice, together with others, unless we find a way to live a good life, shared good life, and in the globalized world, that means unless we pursue the global common good, I think we will not find joy in life. Until we find also within ourselves the resources to rejoice, and we find them when we are able to affirm everything around us as a gift, including the people around us, joy will not come. We can't have joy by ourselves simply. We can't have joy simply in nature. We have to have joy in social and community. And I would say also the source of joy fundamentally is human relationship to the divine, to God.
So now, as a Christian, you would have a certain, if you will, tenet that you might adhere to, as far as that is concerned, as far as your relationship to the divine. And one of the dichotomies that I found in this in my religious studies, I can't remember the name that I came up with some time ago when I was working for the religious radio station. But anyway, one of the dichotomies I found was that we could experience a myriad of different things in the food that we eat and the places that we go and the people that we associate with. And the things that we drink, and the list of those kinds of things goes on and on. And then there is the spiritual aspect, and I'm told, but there's only one way to God. And I'm going, wait a minute, that's inconsistent with all of the other aspects that I just mentioned. How can that be that I can have all of these different foods and all of these different educational opportunities and all of these different job and vocational opportunities, but there's only one way? And I know that a lot of people struggle with that, both who feel and believe that, but also those who are put upon by that philosophy. You as a Christian, what is your, may I ask, how do you feel about something like that? That particular, if you will, bent?
So I think the prior question to whether there is one or many, many ways is whether there is actually one ultimate reality, whether there is only one God or many gods. And if one thinks that there is only one God that holds the entire diversity of everything that is, and sustains it as harmonious unity, then you might ask, well, what might be an access? What is the place in which this God has fully revealed God's self? So I think the question is there only one God? And then we can discuss different ways. I think Christians have always believed that Jesus is the final self-revelation of God, but that there are also other ways in which we can, inadequate or halting way, just like sometimes the relationship to Christ ends up being inadequate, come and have access to the divine reality. Put differently, people who do not believe, it doesn't mean that they don't have a relationship to God. I think that relationship can be strengthened, enlightened, but relationship to God is here for the simple reason that the relationship of the one God to us is always already there. I mean, I believe that every breath we take is given to us because of the divine reality of God, and that same God who was revealed in Jesus Christ. Now, I don't want to shove that down anybody's throat, and you mentioned that I have this as a tenant. I don't know whether I think of it as a tenant. I think of it almost like kind of fundamental kind of dimension of my own life. I can express it in the form of belief, but prior to that belief, there is this fundamental reality of the relationship to God, and even more prior reality of God's relationship to me. That's much more than any tenet can express, just like the love that I have for my wife is much more than any description, even poem, can express. Life is very internally rich in the presence of God, and life is internally rich in the presence of those who we love.
But at the same time, you know, you acknowledge the reality of other religions, that they acknowledge that there is a divine, there is a creator, there is, you know, even in the definitions here in the United States, in Christendom, they use even the term intelligent design in that regard. Well, intelligent design, where'd the intelligence come from? Where is that? Well, that's in a higher power. So does it matter what we call it? As long as we acknowledge it and turn to it, it's kind of like the 12 steps.
You know, but what is the it that we're describing?
Exactly. That's the point. Yeah.
So calling doesn't matter very much. Mm-hmm. But I think calling is a way, what we call it, doesn't matter. There's so many names even in the Christian Bible.
Yes. God.
But what profoundly matters is how we understand it. For instance, it matters whether the ultimate reality is impersonal, force, mm-hmm. power, or is it personal? Mm. It matters, for instance, whether divine reality fundamentally demands something from us, and to be merciful, we need to earn that mercy from the divine, from God, or is the God's does God unconditionally love individual human beings and human race? Now, these debates are about nature of God, and they're fundamental to mm-hmm. how we conceive our own lives and how we relate to other people. So I can say, you know, different people call God in different names, but the most important question is, do they mean by God the same thing? And I've just given you some examples. First one, obviously, was Buddhism. Second was obviously Islam. And third was certain forms of Christianity. Those are important debates to be had. And I think that's why you have theological debates. They don't, great religions, they don't say the same thing. They say partly the same thing, but partly different things. And often they are in significant tensions with one another, and those tensions, they matter for the entirety of the way of life in which we lead.
All right, and to that end, we talk about this aspect of globalism, and if you have that kind of tension between the various religions or belief systems or philosophies, what is your answer to the question, how do we work cooperatively and united for a world where we can flourish when we have these kinds of, I guess you would say, fundamental differences?
I think we do have fundamental differences. We also have significant commonalities. And one of the commonalities among world religions is actually that all of them emphasize freedom of religion to different degrees and partly in different ways, but it's a significant element in all world religions. Because human being is addressed by world religions as individuals, and the human being ought to have the right and is understood to have capacity to respond to that call of the divine. And that's why freedom of religion is very important. And if we don't identify or commingle politics and religion, then there will be no reason to not to insist on the freedom of religion. And if you have freedom of religion and radical equality of all human beings, or freedom of conscience, you can put it this way, to include people who are obviously not religious, these two things together, robustly held, will allow for the debates among various religions and our religions to take place in a respectful way. I ought to respect every individual, even if I disagree with the position that they have. I respect my friends who disagree with me, who are either Muslims, which I have many Muslim friends, or who are atheists, which I also have many of those. And I think it's possible in our individual lives, in our social lives, to do just that.
Would you, and you mentioned one group, the atheists, I don't know about your experience. I've had the privilege of interviewing an atheist or two, and one of the things that I found so fascinating was, in spite of their not believing in God, the way in which they spoke, the words they used to describe their I'll call it philosophy of life, was very spiritual, and that they wanted to have community. They wanted to have relationships that, in this context, as you and I are sharing here, that flourished. They wanted to thrive, but they also didn't want to have these concepts, as you used the term earlier, jammed down their throats, that they wanted to believe or not believe as they chose to do so. So I found atheists to be very, in my experience, to be very spiritual people.
I think people people obviously differ. Yes, I found spiritual in the sense that you describe, mm-hmm. in a sense that they, you know, I can think concretely of atheist friends who are taking very seriously the question of the meaning of human existence, who lead extraordinarily lives of extraordinary integrity and beauty and so forth. You know, I admire them in many different ways, mm-hmm. you know. And I've read just about everything that Karl Marx, for instance, has written, because I've written a dissertation on Karl Marx. I have studied Nietzsche very, very carefully. Those are two very significant atheists, and both of them, as a matter of fact, thought that the concept of idea of flourishing or idea of living a responsible and deeply human life was significant to both of them. Very differently, but it was important. There are spectacular examples of great people among atheists, and there are spectacular examples of lousy people among theists.
I understand that completely. This is fascinating to me. I'm very grateful for the time that you have given us here on the program. I still have a few more questions for you before we wrap up our broadcast here. But again, I want to remind our listeners that we are talking to the author of Flourishing, Why We Need Religion in a Globalized World. Miroslav Volf is my guest. He is a professor of theology at Yale University, and we are grateful for his time. And as I put to all of my guests, three final questions, answer them in whatever way you choose to, and elaborate as much as you wish. And again, thank you so much for sharing your time with us. The first question is, who is Miroslav Volf?
Miroslav Volf is a human being who, at the core of his life, wants to be a follower of Jesus Christ, and through Jesus Christ have a relationship to God, which in turn makes it possible for him to find joy in understanding and delighting in the world as God has created, especially with close family and friends.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Most important question that has motivated my work through my entire career was the question which I sought to answer as I started studying theology and philosophy when I was some 15, 16 years old. And that is to say, what does it mean for me as a human being to succeed? Not to succeed in this or that endeavor that I have, but to succeed as a human being, to have a life that I will look back on and say to myself, this indeed was a truly human life, life worthy of living. And I think my calling is really to help myself first, but also others, to discover what does it mean to live a life worthy of human beings, and to find ways in which we can actually live such lives together as communities.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
Well, in some ways, I've already answered my life's purpose when I mentioned these things in previous given my previous answer. But I mean, different way to put the same thing. I have to go back to the biblical text. I want my life's purpose to be to truly love God and truly love my neighbor. I have my own ways in which I do that, and each of us has our own specific ways that are tied to our own particular biographies. And I do that as a teacher. I do that as a writer. I do that as a kind of public intellectual, speaking to a variety of audiences, trying to elicit from us a life that would be life that's to the glory of God and expression of the love that I believe is at the foundation of the entire reality.
I am, again, extremely grateful for the time that you've shared with us here on the program, and look forward to an opportunity to chat with you more, because you've written some extraordinary books in addition to this one, Flourishing, Why We Need Religion in a Globalized World. And I encourage people to investigate. I think one of the saddest things, Miroslav, is the fact that a lot of what you and I have discussed, a lot of people aren't even aware of, and they won't, for whatever reasons, they are not willing to investigate the source material to truly understand. And that's part of what we're encouraging people to do, is to do just that. So I encourage you to do that. And I know it can be challenging, because I know that a lot of the philosophical treatises are in other languages and they get translated, and you know, that can be challenging as well, but we encourage you to do that. And again, Miroslav, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Thank you very much for having me. All the best to you.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.